We're beginning our semester in Binyan HaBayit, and our class here divides into two sections. The first half of the class we read from Rav Eliyahu Kitov's book, Ishu Beito, The Jew in His Home, which you guys can purchase. It's published by Feldheim, if I'm not mistaken, in English. And the second half of the class, we discuss topics externally. We just discuss all kinds of things. And tonight, we have so much topics that I want us to discuss that I'm not sure we're going to get to Rav Eliyahu Kitov. If we do, good. If not, the next week we'll start with Rav Eliyahu Kitov. Give me just 1 second. We're going to begin with, I want us to cover three topics tonight. One is negative reinforcement, and two is old relationships with people of the opposite gender, and three is a story. So we'll begin with a story. The story I was sent by email yesterday. The woman writes the following. My husband and I got married 15 years ago. Our families both tried to help with whatever they could. Each one did what they could to help us get started. And we had a pretty nice wedding. And they bought us a relatively nice apartment. And we were relatively happy. Before the wedding, my husband's grandmother came to give me a gift. She took out of her bag a small box that was carefully wrapped, and when I opened it, I saw inside a ring with a diamond. I was no expert in diamonds, and even I could see that this was a very, very precious gift. It was a gorgeous, huge diamond. I had never seen such a diamond in my life. Everyone was amazed. And the grandmother told me that this was her gift for our wedding. It turns out that the grandmother would buy every kala in the family a very expensive jewel, a type that people hold on to their whole life. And she said she was doing it so that they'd remember her. And the truth is that this grandmother didn't need any gift in order to be remembered. She was a beautiful, aristocratic woman, and she was so sweet that everyone loved her without any gifts. But this is the custom, so why should I argue about such a custom? Especially if the ring was worth $50,000. Yeah, that's what the ring was worth. And how do I know this? In a second, I'll tell you. When my father saw this ring, he said, "This is decrepit to wear such a ring when people are walking hungry in the street." On the other hand, I too felt like guilty wearing such a ring. But aside from the guilt feelings, there were some other pangs that only a woman would understand. The ring was big on me. And every woman knows how upsetting it is to have a ring that's big on you. It's something that drives you crazy. You have to keep checking to make sure it didn't fall off. So throughout the wedding, I kept checking again and again to make sure that the ring didn't fall off. The wedding passed, the Sheva Brachas were beautiful, and the two families made the Shabbos. The wedding passed, the Sheva Brachas were beautiful, and the two families made the Shabbos Sheva Brachas together. Friday night was amazing, singing, speeches, and so too the next morning. After the meal of Shabbos day, we went to walk on the boardwalk by the beach. And then we went to eat Shabbos Sudas until Matzei Shabbos. When Shabbos ended, I looked, and to my fear, I recognized I didn't have the ring on my finger. There started being a small ruckus in the room, and my husband said, I'm going to run and check at home. Maybe you forgot it in the room. I waited, and as the tension mounted, I finished off all my nails, and something in my heart said, maybe he won't find the ring. And the reason I felt that was because I knew that the ring was pretty big on me, and I remembered that it had been a while since I had noticed that I was wearing it. And the truth was that he didn't find the ring.
Under the boardwalk.
My husband came back and proclaimed, the ring's not there. Did you check the closet? Did you check the shelves? He had checked the whole house, any place it could have been, and it wasn't found. At this point, no one in the family, it wasn't concealed from anyone in the family that the ring worth $50,000 was lost. And here's how you know. I knew its value. When you lose something that's that precious, everyone automatically tells you how much it was worth. And this isn't true about jewelry alone, but other things that suddenly everyone notices that it's time to tell you how much what you lost was worth. My shviger, my mother-in-law, went off to our room, and to my shame and disgrace, together with some other sweet aunts, she started checking all our luggage and checking all our personal belongings. After about an hour's worth of their checking, everyone started mentioning ideas where it could be. And here I tried to be helpful, and I mentioned that the ring was a little bit big on me. And of course, so one of the sweet aunts told me, so why didn't you say so in the beginning? And I merited the answer, I did. And that's where the tension began. As we started to recreate what had happened that day, we realized that almost certainly the ring had fallen on the boardwalk. And to search for it is like searching for a diamond in the sand. And as much as this diamond was big, the beach was even bigger. It's difficult to realize at which moment it was that everyone's faces started to seem sour towards me. They thought that how could I have let myself to lose such a ring? Even if they weren't yelling it at me, it was written all over their faces. My husband and I came home totally embarrassed. My husband tried to make a joke. My husband tried to lighten the spirit that was resting between us, but I just poured out all my wrath over him. All the wrath I felt for myself, I poured over him. He apologized and apologized, and nothing would help him. I was hurt to the depths of my neshama, and I was hurt not only from the hurt of losing the ring, but on all the blame that had suddenly fallen upon me. My husband comforted me and explained to me that I wasn't at fault, but anyone that told me that I should wear a ring that was, even though it was too big on me, they were at fault. And mainly he blamed himself. He tried to take all the blame to himself until at the end of the night I admitted to myself that if this was a test, he passed with flying colors. In his family, every time we'd meet, this was hanging in the air. There were all kinds of sly remarks that made my life unbearable. I don't blame them, but it turns out that when someone messes up, especially by losing something that's so valuable, so it costs him a heavy price, much more than the value of the ring. Together with the ring, I lost all the admiration and love that they had felt towards me. It was as though I was suddenly disgusting in their eyes. How much could you love someone that has so little responsibility that they could lose something worth $50,000? What is she, a little child? You can't expect her to watch anything that's of value. Some long and sad months passed, and I felt like I would never be able to look good in the eyes of the family. Losing this ring became a staple on me, and it became a sign that I am not responsible and no one could rely on me. Not only that, I'm just one of those angry people that could lose such a valuable ring. The climax came when at some point we bought some vase, and one of the brothers said to my husband, better you carry it, you know. He said it in front of me and in front of everyone, and I just burst out like I'd never burst before. And I said, I'm never stepping foot in that house again. They're spilling my blood. I said many things that scared even me. And then, the fight that my husband kept trying to put off came. He didn't really tell me what had happened, but I understood that he had fought with his brothers, and he told them that if they don't stop digging into me over it, he's going to detach himself from the family. And then we reconciled. We had a meeting where the whole meeting was uncomfortable, and the Shviger apologized, and she said that really she loves me more than all her other daughter-in-laws, and I answered for sure that she was. I always felt that, and all the things that that really are uncomfortable were said, and bottom line, I came out totally wiped, and we made believe everything was peaceful, but it was a cold peace. I felt finished, and I thought that I didn't have a chance, and throughout my life I would just never be loved by them. The tide changed when 4 months later that he wears for holidays, and as he was preparing for Rosh Hashanah, he whisks that suit out of the closet, wears it, and asks me if it's still fitting him. And then he starts pounding on his chest. I got scared. I ran up to him. I said, something happened. He stuck his hand into the pocket of his suit, and he took something out. My ring. What else? We looked at the ring for a few minutes without saying a word. And I remember what he said. He said, I'm shocked. I guess I put it in my jacket pocket. We sat one opposite the other, and I just started crying. Maybe I was so excited. Maybe from all the tension that suddenly left me. He right away called his mother and told her about the ring that was found. And then there started being an Aliyah L'Regel. His parents came, his brothers came, everyone came and said, what a beautiful ring. Finally, the grandfather and grandmother themselves came and expressed their joy at the fact that the ring was found. Everyone breathed a sigh of relief, and of course they begged my forgiveness that they blamed me for being so irresponsible. And at the same time, everyone remembered that how could they have not remembered this, that my husband is known as the one that forgets things and you can never rely on him. My husband maybe was a little bit insulted by this, but he was so happy that we found the ring that overcame it. From that moment on, to this day, I became the queen of the family. Everyone understood that they had made a mistake, and I'm a responsible person that never lost anything. I felt like I was in heaven. Suddenly, everyone gave me so much love and apologies like I never got in my life. And my husband, even if he was a little bit insulted by the blame that he got, he was very happy for me. And he benefited that suddenly he had a wife who was happy and happy in her lot. And there was a good atmosphere and shalom bais, and things were well between us. But the story is not over yet. Anytime I could, I'd make mention about the ring. If it was about money that I preferred he didn't hold large sums by him, or anything that really you had to rely on someone, I'd tell him, maybe it's better you give it to someone else. Maybe it's better someone else should hold it. You know, we don't want it to get lost in a box of sand. And the word of box of sand became some kind of term between us that I'd used to hint to him what had happened with the ring. I'm ashamed to tell that I think I used his weakness, and I think many people often use weaknesses to hurt other people, and I'm sad, but that's what I did. My husband suffered quietly and he didn't complain. There were times that I saw the pain on his face and I'd regret it and try to appease him, but other than this, he almost didn't complain. Our life passed peacefully. We had 7 children, 7 beautiful children that loved their parents and honor them. Everyone grew up, and everyone knew the story of the ring by heart, but they thought that mommy had lost by the beach, and it turns out that daddy, who was so disorganized, had forgotten it in his suit. 15 years passed. What? The ring still serves me as an ornament when I went to family affairs, and I merited getting many compliments. But then one day, I thought maybe I should exchange the ring for some other jewelry. I wanted to do it as a surprise for my husband, so I turned to my Shviger and asked her to tell me, where did Grandma buy the jewelry. And she told me the name of the jeweler, a well-known jeweler, and I went to him at the first opportunity I had. I gave him the ring, and I told him, it was bought by you, and I want you to appraise it for me. He looked at the ring and whistled. He said, this is a gorgeous ring. This is really gorgeous. It costs a lot of money, more than $60,000. And I don't mind to exchange it with you for anything you want. But just so you should know, I didn't sell this ring. I said to him, what do you mean? I told him my husband's grandmother's name. I said, didn't she buy this ring by you? And he said, no, you're right. She bought many expensive pieces of jewelry by me, but a piece like this, I never sold. She must have bought this somewhere else. I came home and decided to look a little bit in our jewelry box. And there at the bottom, underneath all kinds of other documents and all kinds of other documentation of jewelry that we had, I looked for the certificate of this specific piece of jewelry, and I found it. The truth is that this piece of jewelry wasn't bought by him, but in another well-known, wealthy, expensive store. And the price really was $50,000. But then I understood another detail that I had missed until then. I looked down, and I looked for something that ordinarily I wouldn't have looked for. I waited till my husband came back from work. With my heart pounding like a machine, he walked in. And I told him that I thought to exchange the ring and that I went to the dealer that the grandmother would buy by him, and he said that it's now worth $60,000. So he said, great. So we made money. Yeah, I said to him, but the dealer told me he didn't sell that piece of jewelry. The jewelry was bought elsewhere. Could be, he said. Fine. You're telling me that it could be that your grandmother bought this piece of jewelry somewhere else? What's your problem? He asked me. And then I started crying. The problem, I told him, I'll tell you what my problem is. That it's been 15 years, and I don't begin to understand what kind of wonderful husband I have. That I don't even deserve such a husband. You did it in such a beautiful and elegant way. I lost that ring, and you quietly went. I don't know how you did it. You must have taken out many loans. You bought me a new ring. No, don't try to get out of it. You did it in the most elegant way and the smoothest way it could have been done. And you found exactly the same ring at the same price. But one thing you forgot, the date on the certificate. And then I placed before him the certificate that the piece of jewelry was bought 4 months after our wedding. Maybe you forgot, I told him, but I still remember the date we got married. Your grandmother bought me that ring before the wedding. So at any rate, this piece of jewelry was bought 4 months after our wedding. And the date gives you away. And then I started crying. I can't explain the thoughts that go through me. What kind of young man could take out a loan for $50,000 in order to cause his family to have faith that he was the one at fault in this whole story? And I knew I was the first woman to ever receive such a gift. I'm not talking about the ring that's worth $50,000. I'm talking about the 15 years of blame that was taken off of me and given to him. And what was it given to him?
He paid $50,000.
Till this day...
He has a grandmother, so he's trying to borrow his grandmother.
This is a story, I don't know. To this day, I cringe when I think how many times I hurt him, and specifically at this point that I shouldn't have hurt him. Specifically at the point, on the point that was his greatest point. He sat down and he told me everything that passed over him, how he had to pay back that money, how many loans he had to take out to get that money. And he explained to me that he understood that he couldn't clear the air between me and his family if they won't believe that I didn't lose the ring. It took him years to return the loans, and the hardest thing was to do it all the time that he wasn't telling me. But every time I'd sting him, so he'd remember what he had gotten back. He'd gotten back a wife that was relatively happy, peace of mind, and a peaceful home. She ends off the story, she says, at first glance, this is a story of a ring, but the truth is, at first glance, this is a story of a jewel. But the truth is, this is the story of a heart that's all gold. So I thought it's a nice way to start our semester. Something to think about. The Rambam writes in his explanation on the Mishnah that there are different.
Is this a true story?
I think so.
So, you think, like, you know how, like, people go on the beach with metal detectors? Some guy would say, find, like, a nice big ring.
The Rambam writes that there.
He just bought it as the guy with the detector card.
Could be.
Okay.
I thought we'd discuss it, but I see you guys have what you have to say. Okay. So now, what? I think that there are enough messages without discussing the story. I don't think every message that's taken from the story is correct, by the way. I think if you read between the lines, you see that she says she makes a lot of mistakes. She doesn't only make the mistake of stinging her husband on points which no person has a right to do, even if he did lose it. She also makes the mistake of describing their happiness as emanating from the material. I don't know if you guys noticed, when she describes in the beginning of the story, she says, both families helped us with whatever they could. We had a pretty nice chuppah. They bought us a relatively nice apartment. Notice how everything she's given is relative, like it's relatively nice, pretty nice chuppah. And all in all, we were pretty happy and joyous. Happy and joyous has to do with the monetary goods you have? I don't think so. I think King Solomon teaches us quite the contrary. There are a few points here that we should really analyze that I wouldn't agree with, but okay, it's interesting to hear how she presents it. I want us to go on to negative reinforcement, and I'm going to post this on the bulletin board. We are constantly trained to be in control of our feelings. The Torah tells us, Lo sachmod, shall not covet. The Torah tells us, we're not allowed to hate a fellow Jew. The Torah tells us, we're supposed to love a neighbor as oneself. The Torah tells us, we're not allowed to bear a grudge. The Torah tells us, we're supposed to love Hashem. You know what it means not to bear a grudge? That means that you desperately need a car, and your neighbor has three cars sitting there doing nothing, and he says no. And the next day he comes and he sees your rented car, and he says, "I noticed you're not using it right now. Can I borrow it for a few minutes? I've always wanted to test drive one of those cars." And not to bear a grudge means that you're not supposed to say you, and we'll leave the rest blank. You're supposed to either say, "I'd love to," or you could say, "Look, I have insurance on that car. I'm responsible for whatever happens to it. I don't want to take the responsibility of lending it out right now." But not because you're bearing the grudge of his saying no yesterday. The Torah tells us that we're not allowed to abhor an Edomite. We're not allowed to abhor an Egyptian. The Torah tells us not to covet. So we have many, many places in the Torah that the Torah tells us we're responsible to channel our thoughts, our feelings, our traits. A person cannot say, "Well, my neighbor's wife is so gorgeous, you want me not to covet her?" Yeah, the Torah says, "Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife." Finish, end of story, you shouldn't even notice it. But my neighbor has a Rolls Royce and I don't have a car. Yeah, the Torah says you're not allowed to covet your neighbor's objects. The Torah keeps stressing to us that service of Hashem is contingent upon our heart. It's also contingent upon our actions, but it is contingent upon our heart. And we have to purify our heart and purify our thoughts. And part of the service of Hashem is to serve Hashem in happiness. And one of our lifelong tasks is to perfect our heart, to become better people. when we're working on becoming better people, so our sages taught us that Hachitzoniyut mashpiot al pnimiyut. The external affects the internal. Things that we think, well, that's external. So the Torah teaches us it can affect the internal. But we're supposed to control as much as we can. So on the one hand, a person can't say, well, someone just ran into my car. Of course I'm going to yell and scream and not have patience for my kids. No, that's when things are tense, so that's when you should be taking control. By the same token, a person is not supposed to do things that will encourage him to have negative traits. There was a story in a court in Europe that they brought a bunch of rambunctious youths into the courthouse, and they were making noise, and the judge threatened them with this punishment and that punishment. And they just laughed at the judge and started yelling even more. And everyone was shocked. Like, they never saw such a thing in a courtroom. So the judge sees that the police can't get these kids to be quiet. And he can't get the kids to be quiet. So he ordered the police, he said, don't threaten them with anything right now. Take them all out. Shave all of their heads. Take off all of their hair. Then you bring them back in. They took all the kids out, shaved all their heads, and brought them back in. And the kids are silent. So the external can affect the internal. Chazal taught us that the gava, a lot of a person's pride, is connected to his hair. And when we take that off, so we're a little different. It does something to a person. Modern psychology very often encourages us to express our feelings. And on certain levels, that's true. Certain levels, a person has to, sometimes in order to come to terms with things, he has to speak about them. But this concept is sometimes misused. And it backfires when it's misused. If I have a roommate that's unclean, so I smell that he's unclean. I know that he's unclean. I can do one of two things every time I encounter him. I don't know how much longer I'm able to stand this. This guy's getting on my nerves and he's driving me crazy. I'm going to count to 10 and see if he's far enough away that I don't smell him. 1, 2, 3. What am I doing? I am giving expression to my nerves. And this only causes my nerves to be more heightened. I'm now aware of every second that he's near me. And every second now seems like an eternity. I can say to myself, let's see if I could be nice to him. Let's see how I can make him happy. Let's see what I can do. I could try to alter my thoughts or channel them positively. I'm going to walk away from the encounter, from encountering this person, much calmer, much more amiable. Some of you guys were by us this Shabbos morning. So you merited to see our children a little bit antsy. And sometimes a parent is walking with a baby at 2 o'clock in the morning. If the baby has colic. So the kid's wailing and you try to calm down. Nothing's going to work. So you do it the first hour, fine. Second hour, your nerves start getting shot. Well, you do it the first hour, fine. Second hour, your nerves start getting shot. When you hit 2 o'clock in the morning and you don't see yourself getting to bed and you don't see the baby calming down, that's when you start losing it. And the question is, what do you do then? So some people throw the baby down the window and they get put in jail and everyone looks at them like they're nuts. And some people start yelling at the baby. I used to take out my son for a walk. Sometimes that would calm him down. What was interesting was that sometimes as I was taking him for a walk, I'd hear other people, and you hear the yelling. Listen, quiet, your you see people, they're at their wits' ends, and they're begging the baby. They're having like these intelligent conversations with a baby, a 3-month-old, a 6-month-old, and they're begging him. Now, Is it going to work? It's not going to work. Is it going to make the parents calmer? No. I'm telling you, I heard this. They're staying there and they're begging. There was a parent who I'd meet like as I was walking the baby. And it was interesting. I'd see him and it would calm me down. He's standing there trying to calm the baby and you see him shaking and he's talking to the baby and he's begging the baby and he's pleading with the baby. What do you want? Tell me, please, whatever you want. I'll give you the car. I'll give you whatever you want, please. If you could stick in that much humor, then you're already one step forward. The problem is that sometimes it goes the other way around. And what's worse is when we attribute negative names. If a parent starts talking to a baby when a baby's wailing and says, "Listen here, you brat," that's it. You gave him the word brat. Now, in the parent's mind, he has changed it from being a difficult situation to a difficult baby. And that's a world of a difference. Meaning, when we think about situations, we can define the situation. And in defining the situation, we're also defining how we're going to react to it. When reacting to a situation, it's very important to recognize this is difficult. Not he is difficult, she is difficult, the baby or the person is difficult. And this applies both to spouses and to children. And I'm going to post on the bulletin board a summary of what we just discussed with many examples. I think you guys should read it because these are things that people encounter day in and day out. And the difference between labeling the child as being negative and labeling the situation as being difficult is a world of a difference. It's classical that wives want to talk to their husbands in the morning and husbands want to read the paper. In more firm circles, a husband wants to learn and the wife wants to talk to him. When I was getting married, so we were contemplating what kind of apartment to look for. So one of my rabbeim told me, look for an apartment with 3 rooms if you can afford it. So I said, what do I need 3 rooms for? Me and my wife have a bedroom, there'll be a kitchen, and some other room we eat in, which is usually attached to the kitchen. So he said, look, I'm sure you're marrying a tzaddikis, but you should know that there's no such thing as a tzaddikis in this world that can stand the situation where her husband is right near her and she won't talk to him. You can't expect that from any woman. That doesn't exist in this world. It doesn't exist. As much as a woman will want her husband to learn Torah, it doesn't exist. There doesn't exist a woman who can be in a situation where she sees her husband and she won't talk to him. So if you're going to get any learning done when you're home, it's your best interest and your best investment to invest in an apartment that has another room. So imagine, I have a lot of friends who I give this advice to, and imagine a person is sitting down to learn and puts down his head and he starts focusing on Hamelah. And he's trying to make heads or tails, so he understands this word and that word, and then his wife comes and talks to him. So the first time he asks himself, how important was that? Not very. Okay. But he doesn't say anything. He answers her. He puts his head back into the Gemara. And the second time, he doesn't even have to think about it. He realizes what's going on here. So if he's been to our Binyan Abayit class, he knows that one of the ways that maybe one of the main ways that women connect with people that they like is through speech, in contradistinction with men. Men connect differently. Men use speech for practical things. So when a woman speaks to a man's always looking for the practical. What did she want? And the woman, she didn't want anything. She wanted to connect with him. So he knows that. But even if he knows that, he's going to ask himself, well, doesn't she want me to learn? Oh, she's not religious. She's, and you should know, this is a common thing, especially here where a lot of guys, if he's a Baal Tshuva, she's a Baal Tshuva, he's a Ger, she's a Ger, however it is, so very often there comes up this feeling, well, how religious is she really? How much does she really care for the learning? How much does she really care to keep mitzvos properly? And this negative quantifying, this negative reinforcement is terrible, because the second you label something as negative, you're going to find 100 reasons to believe it's so. And not only will you find 100 reasons to believe it's so, but a person suddenly wears different glasses. Suddenly we look through the glasses, just like when you look at the baby and you say, what a brat. So then, well, he's wailing again and he's, I just got into bed and he's pulling me out again or whatever, however the scenario plays itself out. The same thing is with the spouse. There was a couple that had very serious issues. And they came to a rabbi and he sat and he spoke to them and they decided they're getting back together again. So the rabbi called the husband in and he said, look, if you two are getting back together again, it's on the condition that you get back together again forever. You can't get back together again for a trial period, because a trial period never works. Because if it's a trial period, then your mind, you're constantly asking yourself, yes or no? And if it's a question, yes or no, then you're going to have millions of reasons every day why no. No one can live under the magnifying glass of yes or no. And by the same token, no one can live under the magnifying glass or the glasses that look at a person with a negative outlook. And that's why it is crucial to get into the habit, and today it's important with your roommates and with your friends, and in the future it'll be with your spouses and your children, of not quantifying the person as negative, but rather the situation as difficult, or, as you'll see in the examples that will be posted, I hope, tonight on the bulletin board, to even find positive ways of looking at it. I'll read you one of the examples I wrote. I don't remember anymore. Yeah, go ahead.
What are you supposed to tell this smelly person?
That we'll get to. I just want to remind the newcomers that the things I post on the bulletin board, you're supposed to take for a maximum of 20 or 30 minutes and then put them back. No one's supposed to walk away with it. If you want a copy, let me know and I'll make you a copy. Okay, you'll look at it in the bulletin board. We have I'm going to print it out. We'll post it on the bulletin board. And the third thing, we have another 2 minutes. We have 2 minutes. We're supposed to end 10:15. The third thing I'll post on the bulletin board, and maybe we'll speak about it next week. Okay. So, any other questions? No. Okay. Yeah.
During the Perkei Avot, you're not supposed to. Obviously, it's easy to understand. You're not supposed to spend too much time with women like unmarried people, but also not with your wife. I can understand at a certain point, you gotta be doing everything.
So I think that in order to understand that Mishnah, we have to define what the word sicha means. The Mishnah says al talbe sicha im haisha. It doesn't say al talbe dibur. So that Bezat Shem we'll deal with in our Pirkei Avos class. If you want, afterwards I don't have time tonight. I'll show you Bezat Shem. There's Rashi that defines the word sicha. Sicha doesn't just mean any speech. Sicha means a certain type of speech. Meaning, it's not talking about deciding where you're going to send your child to school or figuring out where you're going to be Shabbos or all kinds of other things. Sicha is referring to a specific type of speech.
Okay, I think I can maybe understand what you're implying, but...
I'll show you the Rashi.
Waste of time speech?
Huh?
Like just waste of time speech?
Along those lines, yeah.
Could lead to morality?
So,
other words.
Let's leave that either to our Pirkei Avos class or to one-on-one session.
Oh,
yeah.
Pirkei Avos class, is it right to say that on today or you will start Pirkei Avos or Sunday?
I had wanted to, but I understood that.